Hi, I'm Sharon Davis, Chief Executive of Young Enterprise, and welcome to our podcast series, Transforming Futures. I'll be talking with special guests from many different walks of life, all of whom have fascinating life experiences and a shared commitment to helping young people build successful futures. We explore how the powerful chemistry of support and opportunity have shaped their own lives, getting their individual takes on the future skills needed across a range of industry sectors, and what more we can do as a society to help young people build and apply those skills. My guest today is Rhian Kelly, Chief Sustainability Officer at National Grid. Rhian oversees all National Grid's ESG activities, including sustainability and how National Grid reduces its emissions, invests in its communities, and supports its people. Rhian joined National Grid in 2017, taking on several public and corporate affairs leadership roles before assuming her current role. Prior to joining National Grid, Rhian was the Director of Infrastructure at the CBI and helped deliver their groundbreaking report on climate change in 2007. She's also spent time in Beijing and Taiwan working for the EU Chamber of Commerce. Welcome to Transforming Futures, Rhian.
It's great to be here.
I'm just going to ask you where you are in the world today, because you're very often working in the US. Are you in the US today?
No, I'm not. I'm actually in our Warwick office today. But you're right, I'm in the US quite a lot.
Well, thank you for joining us. It is very much appreciated. We'll start with that first question about the chemistry of support and opportunity at Young Enterprise. We firmly believe it has got the power to transform futures. What does that sentence mean to you personally?
Yeah, I really like actually the way that you put the sort of chemistry and the support and opportunity together. And when I look back on my career and the things I've done, particularly in light of talking to you, it came together in terms of just thinking about, well, how do you make the most of those moments when they come? And so I think it's really important that you grasp them. They can come, but you might miss them. So there's something for me about how do you step into them, be brave and courageous, and make the most of them.
Yeah, and know that they are, just seeing them for what they are, I think, sometimes
yes.
as well. And I guess there will be moments in your own journey to date where you've had those experiences. Can you share any that spring to mind where that chemistry of support and opportunities influenced your own life?
I had three, actually, and then a little bit earlier in my career, but the first one was probably a sort of an opportunity in terms of a sort of moment where I was at school and I was reading the school magazine, and there was a previous pupil who'd basically spent a year in China. And I said, I want to do that. And I vaguely remember the article. I was about 13, but everything else in my life, personal and professional, comes from that moment and that decision that I was going to spend a year in China. I did get to China. And then my second moment, a little bit around the support, but also around opportunity, I got my first job. So I was in Beijing, I'd graduated from university, I was teaching English, and it was getting into the European Union Chamber of Commerce in China. And Ian Kay, the general manager at the time, needed somebody to support him as a communications manager. And so I had my first job interview ever, and he gave me an opportunity. I'd never worked in a corporate environment before. I recall only having one outfit to wear. I had no idea how to write emails. And so they were coming in to me, and I was like, oh, that's how you do your signature at the end. And oh, this must be the way you write them. And Ian coached me and helped me and explained, and could see my potential, but realized I needed a helping hand. And how do you actually manage in a corporate environment? And then probably the third one, I was at this point, I'd left China, come back to work in the UK, and was working for CBI in London. And I was at that point ahead of climate change. And my boss, Neil Bentley, moved jobs. He was the director of infrastructure. And he said, would you consider applying for my job? And I was like, well, what? And he said, well, I think you'd be great at it. And I was like, well, tell me why you think that would be the case. And he just encouraged me, I think, to lift my sights. And he saw something in me that I didn't see in myself. And I did apply for the job. And I got it. And, you know, but each one of those times, you need to recognize the moment and be brave. And then I had Ian and Neil and others then later in my life who sort of basically nudged me over that line.
Listening to that, I mean, you clearly were learning on the job all the time, particularly with that second opportunity and that support from Ian.
you know, essentially learning all the time, whether it's the outfits, whether it's the social cues, what to wear, and the whole kind of email etiquette, etc. And that, then that third one about, you know, not even considering applying for the job. And what do you think that that person saw in you that you didn't see at the time?
Gosh, I don't know. I guess it's hopefully potential. But how do you understand what potential is? And I guess there's a bit of experience of knowing what potential looks like. I guess maybe I came across as hardworking, willing to sort of do what it takes, which has always been something that's been with me, part of who I am, I think.
And is that a family trait or a skill? Or
I think it's partly a family trait. I think it's something that's just inherent. I think my parents worked very hard. I've always felt that I wanted to be the best and be better at what I can do. So whether you call it tenacity, drive, I don't think I'd call it ambition, but I think I just work hard. I just always want to be better. I'm thinking they probably saw that, and that's a driver for me. To some extent, I had, particularly for Ian, I was a graduate. So, you know, to some extent, that gives you a set of skills. I was also a European, which was important for the chamber.
The reason why I asked that question is that within this podcast, in these conversations, we're really interested in superpowers. And when young people are thinking about their own skills that they would want to build on, just asking you to kind of perhaps reflect on your own superpower skills that you'd credit for your journey to date. You know, what would you say they were?
Yeah, so one is that piece around hard work, that I've always just wanted to be the best or better. I'm not sure I'm competing with anybody other than myself, but it's how I've turned that competitive edge into hard work and wanting to better myself. And I think I've always been like that. I don't think I learned to be like that. In fact, many ways I've had to learn to manage it so that it isn't a weakness. But I definitely...
Tell me more about that.
Well, I think sometimes you can be the worst. The best side of competitive is you're the best side of you work hard. But if you work too hard, you can perhaps not have work-life balance. And you can perhaps forget that there might be other priorities. And so, you know, you can work as many hours as you want. You might also want to spend time with friends and family. You might want to have some time relaxing. You know, there's a sort of mental well-being and work-life balance here. And I think I've had to probably learn to pull a little bit back on being working too hard, just to make sure that, you know, because the other thing, you know, I'm married, I've got family, I want to spend time with them. And I've had to maybe deliberately just make sure that I keep it in check.
That's interesting, isn't it? Because I think there'll be senior leaders listening to this, whether they're walking the dog or, you know, washing up, also grappling with that, you know, working harder, working smarter, you know, really having time for yourself and your family and managing that work ethic. It is an ongoing kind of navigation, isn't it, really, in some ways?
Yeah, I definitely think that's true. And actually, I've used a couple of moments in time to help. So I have always worked hard. I mean, I spent 5 years working in China and, you know, it is just very busy and I work really long hours. But I guess I got pregnant and had a couple of weeks where I felt awful and I really had to think about, well, I'm going to step back now. And I found for the first time ever, I shortened my hours to what would be probably a more of a normal day and was just as productive. And so I used that moment in time to slightly shift. And then the other moment in time was COVID, because I sort of stepped into a new role, a bigger role, and we all sort of went to ground or, you know, stayed at home. And I realised that I wasn't doing any physical exercise. And so for the first time ever, I felt I actually need to get out. So I made myself run a couple of times a week. And in this a new world of a new job, working from home, homeschooling, I realised it wasn't about getting fit. It was about space and time, just took the edge off. And it was actually about my well-being. And at first time it clicked, the link between finding a space for yourself and exercise, I think worked for me. It might not work for everybody. And now, it is absolutely embedded in what I do every week. And not because I necessarily want to be fit, but because I just need, however long it is, just to take the lid off the pot or see wood for trees or however you want to describe it. And I find it just keeps me balanced and reminds me of what's important, and I'm sort of slightly able to come back and stand back and sort of then get on with the things that really matter and not get distracted by the things that might, the distractions. It sort of creates, I think it almost allows me better focus.
It's really interesting you should say that, because I've recently discovered yoga, and not for any other reason than it just gives me like 2 hours or 3 hours a week where you just focused on yourself, and it's there's something about that. You're, to your point, just taking the lid off the pot, isn't there?
Yeah, and I don't think it, I think everybody, some exercise, yoga might work for some people. It might be something else for others, but it's that just taking a bit of time for yourself that you just, I just think helps keep everything in balance.
So you talk about the superpower in its, it can also be a weakness, but there's a strength certainly in working hard. What else would you credit for your journey so far?
So I think I've been hardworking and I've had to learn, and we talked about work-life balance. The one that I think I possibly picked up as I went along was about ways of communicating, being open and honest. So I think I might have had that as a value anyway, but living in China, the Chinese are quite straightforward. People might call it blunt, but I find it quite direct. You know where you are, how they think, and there's no sort of hidden agenda. And I found that quite refreshing. And I think sometimes what you don't say is just as important as what you do say. And, you know, there's always the situations where you're in a meeting, but the real meetings happen outside the room. And so I think it impressed upon me the need for open and honest communications, clarity. By doing that, you get a similar response and you build teams that are open and honest and have clarity. And then you end up building high performing teams. And so I've sort of stuck to that and expect that of myself and expect it of people around me. But I think I learnt it, appreciated it, spending time in China where it's just part of the culture. Maybe people don't like it because it's, in China it's so direct. But I find it, if you can sort of make it appropriate to the situation, I find it really helpful because you know where you are.
Yeah, that communication, that clarity reminds me, I don't know if you know, of the writer and researcher Brené Brown. She talks about the dirty yes. So it's kind of saying yes, but you mean no, really. And
yes.
It sounds like you found a way of really providing an environment that enables your teams to kind of surface problems, talk about them openly. And
I'd like to think so. And I frequently talk to the team about the importance of open and honest communications, that they can expect it from me, but I then expect it in return. Only by getting into that frame can you really resolve, create great work, but also resolve any of the challenges. So it helps with clarity, I think.
And the industry that you're leading in, the energy industry, is so fast-paced. You're needing to have very clear lines of communication, aren't you?
I think that's absolutely right. We're going through a massive change, both in the energy sector, but also in the organisation. We're about to pivot into a period of growth for National Grid. And so the ability to communicate clearly, quickly, openly, honestly. Grid does amazing stuff and has got the most skilled engineers. And it's very complicated. So there's also the skill of being able to provide clarity is really important, because sometimes you need to explain very complicated things in a very simplified way, internally as well as basically to explain to external to National Grid what we do, why we matter, the impact we're going to have.
And that being able to describe something that's very complicated in a very simple way is a massive skill in itself, isn't it?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that.
So again, sticking with the energy sector, you've kind of talked a little bit about the changes. You know, what do you anticipate those being in the future, and what do you think the new skills will be needed for people who are coming into the sector wanting to be successful?
So I think there's probably a couple of trends in the energy sector. One is that obviously we're going to decarbonize, so we're going to move from power generated by fossil fuels, so coal and gas, and we'll end up having power generated by renewable energy, so wind, solar panels, waves in time. And we'll also probably, in that shift, we'll shift also the way that we, where we make that energy, because although there's wind available onshore, not everybody likes a wind farm in their backyard. So we're putting more and more wind in the sea. And so it just changes the way the energy system works from a smaller number of large power plants to basically a larger number of smaller wind turbines or solar panels. And that has a consequence for National Grid, because what we do is transport that power to where it's needed in businesses and homes. We'll need to reconfigure those transmission lines, or to make sure that we're able to connect up the wind that's being generated in the North Sea and the Irish Sea to make sure it gets into people's homes and businesses. So there's quite a lot of change around the decarbonisation. But as we do that, we're trying to do it in a smart way and a digital way. So data, the role of data, understanding how we embed these new technologies is really important. And I think there's a place where our energy system used to be power station to home, there's a world coming, to some extent sort of starting to exist now, where it's two-way. A great example of this, you might have your electric vehicle, you might drive into your home, plug it in, and actually you might give power into your home as well as take power from the grid. And you sort of get this sort of like more interactive use of energy from consumers and from households and from businesses. This sort of more democratization of energy. So it's a really rapidly shifting sector, both in the UK, in Western democracies, but frankly all over the world. So we do quite a lot of work sharing our expertise with the global south. So this is a sort of problem that exists for everybody, really, in terms of the shift and the need to make sure that we have cleaner forms of power.
And so that democratization of energy, I'm going to link that to the work of social mobility. Yes. That's very important to Young Enterprise, place-based social mobility. As you were talking about that journey from the waves to people's home and that configuration. Now, I know that at National Grid, social mobility is very important. And by the way, congratulations on being one of the top 50 social mobility employers. Why is social mobility so important to you as an employer? And what are your top priorities to shift that dial when it comes to increasing social mobility?
Thank you for the recognition on what we've done and the social mobility index. We're really proud to improve, actually, and get those improvements recognised externally. So there are a number of reasons it's really important for us as a business. One is we don't have all the answers for the future and how we get to net zero. And so we need all the ideas we can get. And therefore, we want sort of more diverse thinking to come into the business. And I guess when I think about diversity, I think about all forms of diversity, what you can see and what you can't see. So if we can bring this in, if we can bring in fresh thinking, it will complement the brilliant engineers we already have and I think help us then to transition more successfully. And then the business is about to grow. So we're starting to think about how do we work across the business. So I work in the sustainability team, but how do we partner up with our HR team to create the right talent pipeline to match that growth in the business? And how do we get more people into our business? So part of that is setting new talent targets. So targets around diversification of our apprenticeship schemes and our graduate schemes. But it's also a little bit deeper than that. I mean, the reason to set targets is the old adage that what gets measured gets managed. But also we're looking at trying to think a little bit outside the box. So looking at the qualifications and thinking about, well, do you always need all the qualifications? And are there other routes into the business? So one of the things I particularly like is in our electricity distribution business in the UK, we have some sort of like pre-apprenticeship schemes where people come and sort of shadow people in our tool shops for a year, get to know the business, get to understand what it's like to be in the workplace, and then they apply for the apprenticeship scheme. I quite like that because I think it maybe breaks down some of the barriers that people might face immediately going into apprenticeship. It softens that gap from learning into the workplace. The other thing we do in the US is we work 50-50 UK-US, so I just wanted to bring a US example in, is we've also put in place, we have a joint venture with RWE off New York for an offshore wind farm. We put in place childcare arrangements to ensure that people are actually able to get to the workplace and they don't need to sort of worry about those things at the same time. So again, I think that brings in people into our business who might not have thought it was a place for them, but actually realise they've got something to give, and we've made it easier for them to access the jobs that we have.
And I read somewhere about the importance of climate is important. We also need to recognise the importance of people. And I think that's something that's coming through very clearly in National Grid's thinking.
I absolutely agree with that. And as it happens, I was at 28 talks in Dubai. We go along and talk about the role of National Grid and what we're doing. And part of what I do when I'm there is talking about the need to make it a fair transition, that it is about technology and it is about new ways of generating power and getting that power into people's homes. It's also a transition for people and making sure that everybody, it's fair and everybody has an opportunity to take advantage of it. And so this comes to some of the schemes that we run for young people, trying to entice or inspire people who might not have thought about the energy sector and might not have thought it's a place for them, trying to give them enough of a sort of feeling for it that they consider it, then making it easy for those people to then get into our business and stay in our business.
Now, National Grid are doing incredible work via the Grid for Good programme to increase social mobility. At Young Enterprise, we are a proud partner with you on this. And indeed, we've seen real success with young people being more prepared and securing, as we discussed, those life-changing employment opportunities with National Grid. What's your ambition for Grid for Good when it comes to achieving impact for and with young people from communities perhaps facing some of the greatest barriers to social mobility?
So we set Grid for Good up, sort of our flagship programme. We set it up a few years ago with the explicit intention of bringing people from disadvantaged backgrounds into our business and giving them an opportunity. So exactly focused on social mobility. And I think we've evolved it over the years from starting it. So the first time we started it, we sort of focused on the 16 to 24 year olds, giving them work experience, giving support in terms of interview advice, in terms of CV, drafting CVs, working with you and others. And then I think we sort of realised that you can't just do that. And even if you just do that, it's not enough. So we sort of split it into a bit of different parts. So we've built out what we call an engage programme, which is really 3 to 15 year olds, because we realise if you haven't captured the imagination of somebody earlier on in their schooling career, you probably aren't going to then translate them into a job in future. So we do quite a lot of interactive activity. We do a lot of volunteering in the business, getting into schools, basically sort of trying to inspire the earlier years. Mm. And then we sort of have the 16 to 24 year olds and split a little bit. So giving some people a taster of work. How do we prepare people for work? But at the most advanced stages, actually, how do we work with young people and then bring them actually into our business? So how do we create for ourselves a talent pipeline? And since we're about to go through a massive period of growth, how do we make sure that we've got the talent we need for our business? So I think there's different levels of Grid for Good and different outcomes that we'll get from it. But its whole purpose was to promote social mobility for young people and to give them a taster and a sense of what it might be like to be inside National Grid, the energy sector, engineering or STEM roles.
And for me, National Grid's Grid for Good programme, where young people engage in activities linked to real life scenarios and challenges within the energy sector, supported by volunteers, is that powerful example of that chemistry between support and opportunity. And what we're seeing is proof that this combination of support and opportunity is influencing, it's changing the trajectories of young people who now work for National Grid. What can the energy sector, and indeed National Grid, do more to increase young people's access to more applied learning opportunities, especially in that critical transition from education into work?
So I think one of the things that comes to mind when you ask me this question is it all about the qualifications? And of course, we're an engineering organisation, and so we need a sort of base level of qualifications. But I also think mindset is really important. I think you can't teach. And it's about being proactive. It's about thinking ahead. It's about being willing to fill gaps. It's about making things happen, creating opportunities for yourself, and then stepping into them and not being asked to do something, but seeing it needs being done and doing it. I have spent much of my career in policy, advocacy, campaigning, corporate affairs, now sustainability. And so I just assumed this was something that were applied into those sorts of roles. But I was really heartened because I went to one of our substations and the senior project manager or the senior site manager had just recruited in some apprentices. They had the engineering qualifications, but what he said was, well, we have plenty of people at National Grid who are brilliant engineers who can help with the engineering expertise and training up. But I was also looking for this mindset, this proactive mindset piece, and I can't always teach that. It was a really interesting light bulb moment because I thought this isn't just something for corporate affairs and sustainability. This is for all roles, and who doesn't want that? And so there's something for listeners to think about, and I guess young people to think about, is how can you develop that and accentuate it and show it off when you get an opportunity for future employers? Because I recruit regularly looking at that, and I don't always look at, oh, have they got the right experience? Are they right mindset? Can we teach them the things they need to know if they've got the ability to fill gaps and spot opportunities and spot the next thing that's coming?
And I I absolutely 100% agree with you there. Young Enterprise, we talk about an enterprising mindset. It's that ability to adapt and respond to changing situations. Like you're saying, being proactive about stepping in and saying, how can I help solve that problem? And applied learning gives you the opportunity to do that. You know, very often we talk, don't we, about, you know, startups and that failure rate. It drives innovation and iteration, doesn't it? So the more we can drive that. So a mindset is really interesting, because we also invited teachers to ask sector leaders questions to help them prepare young people for the world of work. And I've got a question here from a teacher who said, young children find it hard to conceptualise careers that are not your usual jobs or famous jobs. What would you advise teachers to do to support them to learn about different careers?
Well, I think that's a brilliant question. One of the things that I have done and taken part in is a science fair for Science Week at a local school. And what they did was invite local businesses in, and then we all did activities. So I think I'm based in Hampshire. I think I did something where all the children in school built, with sort of Meccano type equipment, a wind turbine. And we explained that you get the wind to the homes. Somebody else did something to do with aeronautics. Somebody else did something to do with cars. And they were like, you know, junior school kids. So they were sort of 7 to 11. I think translating some of what happens in businesses into just practical, hands-on fun helps people see that it's not that scary, and that it's actually quite applicable to everybody. So I hope that being part of that helped inspire those children to think, this could be for me.
So finding ways to engage the local community, employers, different industry sectors, to really participate in essentially that sounds like applied learning opportunities.
Yes, and you know, and I should link that back to volunteering. So you've touched on it and I've touched on it a bit, but in addition to commitments around skills development, we also have commitments at National Grid, 500,000 volunteering hours by 2030. And the purpose of that is, A, because we know many of our employees do want to spend time in their communities giving back, but also because we've got these really inspiring people doing great jobs. So we want them to go out and share that in the communities and people to be inspired by it.
Yes. Yeah. And we're nearly at the end of our chat, but I think this is a really important one. When we think about young women joining the energy sector, I believe you're the exec co-sponsor of Women in National Grid Network. What does this mean to you, and what opportunities do you see for us to be able to attract more young women to join the energy sector?
Do you know what? Being the exec co-sponsor of Wing is one of the things I love most. I was very late to Women in National Grid, Network. I'd heard about it and I'd never quite found the time to get involved, and I'm kicking myself for it now. And then the opportunity came up to co-sponsor it, and I jumped at it and haven't regretted it. And as I say, wish I'd got involved sooner. They're so important because they do two things. They create belonging. And this, you know, we're talking about how people come into a business. You need to also feel like you belong in a business. And what they do is create networks across the business, and really diverse networks, in the sense of we have people from based in offices, people based on sites, people based in distribution, people based in electricity. So it gives you this kind of interesting network across the business. We have women who might be the only female on that particular site, and they dial into our calls and they just sort of feel a little bit of a sense of belonging. The other thing they do that is so powerful is their brilliant development opportunities, often, in my view, underestimated. And so we have women who chair them, co-chair them, or take a particular project on. And what we find often is that leads to their next job, and they get, you know, many of our co-chairs go on and get promotions, because particularly at that point where you move from doing to managing, it's quite difficult, you know, until you've had a job, you can't talk about managing. But what the employee resource groups and Wing allow people to do is to manage and then talk about that experience to get themselves up the management ladder. So I think they're extraordinary, extraordinary opportunities in business. And I think the fact that we just have one and we have gender targets for new talents, for senior leaders, shows that we're a business that is absolutely serious about making sure we're as diverse as possible and bringing as many women into the business as possible, among other areas of diversity. But my particular focus through Wing is on women. Mm.
It feels like, as part of your commitment to inclusion, and inclusion is a big factor for National Grid, I know, belonging is very much part of that, feeling that you belong and you matter in an organisation is a powerful signposting to inclusion, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess I use belonging and inclusion interchangeably, but you're absolutely right. It creates this sense that everybody's part of National Grid. It's for everybody.
It's been a really insightful conversation, Rhian. I've got one more question. Let's go back to that 15-year-old, Rhian. What's the one or two takeaways you'd give her from your journey so far that would help her on her way?
I think this is tricky. I've thought about what I would say to myself. And I just remember being quite a shy 15-year-old, and I had all the angst of being 15. And I think I'd probably just say, believe in yourself and have confidence, because you can't underestimate that. And I think they're really, and I feel like I learned that later in life. What would I have done differently if I had a bag of it at 15?
I think there are a number of us nodding furiously at that one. I think there definitely is. Rhian, thank you so much for your time. That's it for this episode of Transforming Futures. Thank you for sharing your insights and the great work, the fantastic work that National Grid are doing to provide young people with brilliant opportunities, increasing their awareness of careers and skills in the energy sector. And thank you also for the incredible work you're doing to addressing barriers to social mobility. Really appreciate the opportunity to chat to you.
Thank you for having me.
Next week, as the final episode to round off our Transforming Futures series, I'll be speaking with Julia Hoggett, Chief Executive of the London Stock Exchange Group, about her personal passion for creating more consistent access to support and opportunity, and why, in her own words, the braver I am, the braver I get. Look out for that podcast, which will be available next week.